Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.
Serving spiritual seekers around the world. Unity Online Radio.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from a thankfully crisp day at Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Actually, it's going back up to 90 degrees Fahrenheit, I think, later in the week. But right now, it's in a beautiful low 70s. My guest today is teacher, international speaker, and author Jason Gregory. He specializes in the fields of Eastern and Western philosophy, comparative religion, metaphysics, and ancient cultures. He's the author of The Science and Practice of Humility. Goodness knows we all need that right now. And Enlightenment Now. And then his new book is entitled Fasting the Mind, Spiritual Exercises for Psychic Detox. That's an interesting title, isn't it? So it's a joy to welcome Jason Gregory back to the show. Welcome.
How are you, Paul? It's great to be back on.
I'm about to cough, sorry. No, I'm good. Thank you very much, and I'm glad you're with us again. I had a wonderful time talking about your previous book, Enlightenment Now, and this picks up on some of the themes, but from a slightly different focus. And so let's just jump straight in, shall we? What does fasting the mind mean? What are you talking about?
Well, it's an ancient practice, fasting the mind, which comes from way back in the Indus Valley region of India, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And what I mean, it's very similar to fasting. If you think about fasting the body, when you fast the body begins to naturally heal itself, and you enter a state of equilibrium, and in turn, it has the same effect of fasting the mind. But what I mean by fasting the mind is taking away all of the external distractions and stimuli that we often take in, especially through our eyes and ears, and just allowing the mind to reach a place of equanimity, which we often don't do, especially in the modern day. We're constantly bombarding our senses with stimulation. So this is the complete reversal of that. So we're not taking in any sensory input, and we're allowing our mind to come back into stillness. And in a sense, this practice heals the cognitive impairment that we have these days. You know, so that's basically what the practice of fasting the mind or mind fasting is. It's about, you know, basically hitting the brakes in your life and stopping all of the external stimuli, stopping even your habit of going out and seeking distraction and seeking stimulation. It's about stopping that for it can be a periodic practice, but it can also infect your lifestyle as well.
Right. And, you know, it's associated with many cultures, isn't it? They all have ways of fasting. I mean, we talk about renunciation, again, is a form of it from the Christian perspective, and releasing the need to be distracted by all the events and circumstances of our lives. So it is something we can do every day in unity. We call it either denial and affirmation or release and affirmation, because denial comes with some kind of 12-step baggage now that, you know, we don't like to get it confused with. But the idea is that in order for you to affirm something new about yourself, you have to release, you have to learn to unlearn, as they say in the Sufi tradition, right? You have to let go of all the things you think you are, so you can discover who you really are, if you like.
No, it's true. And, you know, a lot of people get hung up, especially people who are spiritually oriented. They think that they should always be actively engaged in the world. You know, they have this tendency. And, you know, we don't have to always, you know, we can take time out in our lives to, like you said, you temporarily, if you want to say denial or renounce the world, to experience deeper states of consciousness within yourself, but also to just, you know, heal your own psychological problems, your own problems in your life, and also, you know, purify your lifestyle. So it's good to have these times to do that. You know, if we're always actively busy trying to change the world or trying to change other people, you know, that often leads us down a very precarious path, you know. So it's better to take sometimes that time out for yourself to heal yourself, which in turn helps others and helps the world.
I think people fear it because it's the idea that I have to give up myself. You know, I'm used to who I am, and this idea that I have to fast or renounce or be detached it seems like we'll have to give up all my pleasures, but really, it's not about that, is it? And you mentioned that a lot in the book, actually, that it's not about going into the forest and renouncing everything, giving up all your possessions. It's really working on detaching from having them central in your life, right? That they are added extras rather than the thing itself. And so you could still have all your possessions, all the things that you do, all your interests, but you're no longer seeing them as the you know, the ultimate authority in your life. They are things that they come and they go, but there is some essence that is free of all these things. So don't have to go into the desert or the jungle to experience this, right?
Exactly, and that's one of the core themes in the East. It's like this act of, you could say, even dispassion. You know, so this act of not being, you know, having all of that, like what you said, but not being attached to it, and not, you know, that's not defining your life. That right. all of those things, those even the belief systems and this and that we have in our mind, are not actually what define us. What defines us is something much deeper than that. And so you have all of these psychological tools or practices that come from the East. Like if you look at a couple of Sanskrit terms, you look at viveka, which is the act of discernment. Which means basically your ability to discern in your own mind those things that are trying to define you, which are all wound up in our ego state of consciousness. But you develop this very strong sense of awareness within yourself that can discern that. And then from there, you begin to access another practice, which is a Sanskrit term, vairagya, which is non-reaction. So you actually begin not to react from those temperaments and that are supposed to define who you are, what you do, and so forth and so on. So you begin to practice this, and all of those things, you know, they're all well and good, and that they can define you in a certain way, in a certain context for other people to associate with you, but deep down they don't really define you. And this is one of the things I mentioned in the book. I mentioned Zhuangzi, the ancient Taoist sage, his philosophy of being in the world but not of it. And that's sort of what he's getting at, that skill of being a human being, but at the same time that aspect of Paul or that aspect of Jason that we can associate with is not really who we are deep within. And we don't have to keep clinging to that idea of who we are and promoting that and believing firmly in that identity. We can sort of build a little gap between that in our own mind, and you know, you still are Paul and Jason to a certain degree, and you can still act in that character, you know, but you have found something much, much deeper within yourself.
Yeah, we just came back from a 10-week sabbatical, my wife and I, you know, and it was meant to be a sabbatical, not just a vacation, and so we were open to particularly to the spiritual awareness. And I remember one time, my wife shared this on the show before, but she was putting out the laundry in the Isle of Lewis in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland, and putting out the laundry in the place we were staying. And she disappeared, and all she was doing was the very simple act of putting out the laundry and feeling the wind on her face and it blowing the clothes and looking out to the ocean. And it didn't matter whether she was herself anymore. She was the laundry. She was the wind. She was the activity of doing what she was doing, but didn't have to have a label of being Wendy, you know. And I thought that's a beautiful moment of breakthrough there, because she's still Wendy, she's still doing her thing, and it was a very normal everyday thing, putting out some laundry, but she was into a whole different awareness of who she truly was at that moment, you know. And she said it was very, very freeing, because I didn't have to be me anymore. I didn't have to, you know, live up to any kind of expectations that I might have on myself or others might have for me. I was simply part of this process, this flow of energy that was enjoying this scene at that time and doing this simple act. And that's what we're talking about, isn't it? It's moving beyond all the things we think we are into this very beautiful place, you know, where we trust intuitive awareness more than we do normally.
Mm. Well, Wendy had a perfect experience of what fasting the mind really is. You know, she merged with the moment, you know, she went beyond her persona system, and, you know, she felt something that we often don't feel every day. You know, most people are busy getting to their jobs, they're busy thinking about the next meeting or thinking about going to meet their friends, and we're in this constant state of busyness that leaves us in this state, you know, this perpetual state of anxiety that we don't, you know, it's difficult to appreciate the wind blowing over your face or the sun, you know, basking sunshine all over your face if you're constantly in this state of busyness and anxiety. So the fasted mind is appreciative of everything in every moment. It can absorb, even if something does come into its state of consciousness that does need to be taken care of, because it is attentive and aware, it can deal with that very efficiently, as opposed to our common state of consciousness, which is anxious and stressful. When we get something that comes into our state of consciousness, we instantly begin to fear. We instantly begin to panic because we're like, oh, not another thing, you know, not another thing I have to take care of. So, that's what it's all about, you know. The difficult thing is how to do that in society, how to have that Zhuangzian state of in the world but not of it. And that's why I provide a lot of lifestyle strategies and that in the book to try and deal with that, because, you know, we're constantly bombarded. You know, I speak about in the book, Paul, about the two aspects of the nervous system. You know, you have the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. Now, the sympathetic nervous system is to do with activity, to do with it's what's activated when we're constantly busy. So, for example, a lot of people will finish their day at work and they will come home and they'll say, I'm just going to chill out. And they turn the TV on or they turn the Wi-Fi on and they scroll Facebook or they watch a movie or so forth and so on. And what they don't realize is that because their eyes and their ears are still stimulated on a subtle level, we are still activating the sympathetic nervous system, even though we feel very chilled out. So what's happening is, all through our day, we're only accessing the sympathetic nervous system. And what this does is this causes a lot of psychological problems within us. This is what promotes a lot of our latent anxiety, our social stress. And a lot of people believe that just sleep itself, when we go to sleep, oh, that's enough to activate the parasympathetic nervous system. And the parasympathetic nervous system is the one that's to do with rest and digest or completely doing nothing. And But it's not enough. And a lot of the traditions, especially in Zen Buddhism, they identified this, that we're not accessing the parasympathetic nervous system enough. And that's why they implemented such rigorous meditation practices such as Zazen and other meditation practices to access that more. And you see this a lot, especially in Tokyo, where you'll see, you know, Tokyo is extremely busy. It's chaotic. But then a lot of people will pop into a Zen temple in the afternoon, and they'll practice Zazen, and the master will explain to them about the parasympathetic nervous system and how important it is to activate that, and how this brings us back into balance instead of just, you know, doing all day, which actually is destroying our mind on a subtle level, and is keeping this subtle state of anxiety humming in us even when we go to bed at night. So, you know, it's very important that people understand, especially this ancient Eastern science of the nervous system, which I speak about in the book.
Well, I think Japan's an interesting case in point, isn't it? Because it's extremely modern, like you say, and people seem to be rushing around a lot, especially in the big cities. And yet there's also that traditional sense of peace and ancient wisdom that is around. You know, every single plot of ground is beautifully tended, or if it's not, it's a forest. You know, it seems to be they've left a huge amount of forests there. But there's a sort of a Zen-like quality to the way they look after their crops, for instance, or their gardens. You know, I never saw a weed. I never saw any litter. There's that sense of the outer stillness and peace and beauty reflects that inner beauty and peace. So they've maintained that in some way, I think, although however modern they are, and because they have the most modern things in the world, these amazing bullet trains, etc. But also have maintained that sense of the ancient, you know. And you're right, you know, you can wander around districts of Tokyo and see numerous Zen temples and just pop in and find some peace right there in the midst of all the activity.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's probably something that we could learn from in the West. I know that, you know, having a Zen temple in Los Angeles, for example, or New York, is probably not a grand idea to the businesses there, but it's probably the best thing that could happen to the local people. And, you know, everything that you're saying, Paul, one of the things, you know, especially with Japan and a place like Korea, which are two very similar countries, it's an interesting mix when you've got that Western business mindset that's come in, the, you know, capitalism, which has basically come into those countries in the last 100 years, mixing with that older tradition. There are some, you know, there are a lot of problems that are developing because of that, but I'm glad, like you said, that there are still those traditional values that are still holding on and still there. And deep down, I think the people actually do still appreciate, it's still part of their psychological makeup. It's part of their archetype, part of their lineage, that they still do have a lot of respect for those traditions. And, you know, that's something that we definitely could learn from in the West.
Absolutely. Well, we are, it seems, speeding up, right? I mean, maybe this isn't the case. Maybe we've always been out of control. I don't know, but it does seem to have got a lot worse with modern technology, you know, Facebook, other distractions, the speed of everything. I've noticed the traffic in Fort Worth, you know, the last 10, 12 years has become very different to what it used to be. We always used to say, oh, well, Dallas is cosmopolitan crazy. They drive like nuts. And we're nice and polite here in Fort Worth. And that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. Everybody seems to be, you know, overwhelmed. And of course, the you know, the news media bombards us 24/7. So we never can escape from that craziness. And so it seems to be. But then you mentioned in the book that even Confucius was counseling not to listen to certain kinds of lascivious music. So, you know, it's always been with us, I guess, these distractions. Is it getting worse, do you think?
Yeah, I feel it is. I feel like what you said, you know, you noticed in Fort Worth, even the traffic is getting crazier. That might be a small example, but I feel in general like like you said, like with the amount of information in the world, with all of the advent of modern technology, everything's geared towards being faster, being more efficient, trying to be quicker at what you do, trying to pack in all of these things. And what some people are starting to recognize is that, you know, though that's all well and good, human beings are not robots, and we're terrible multitaskers, you know. So, you know, we're much more efficient at one thing at a time. You know, we're much more, well, we are natural, we are nature. And so we're not like a computer, but I think that people are trying to mimic being like a computer these days, you know. So we take care of all of our social media, we take care of our emails, you know, we're trying to upload programs into even to our own mind. Okay, so I want to know that information. So they go and they watch a few 5-minute YouTube clips or read a brief part of a book, and they think they understand that. And you actually don't, you know. To understand something deeply, you have to take your time with it. You have to actually study it properly, and then you can speak on it as an authority. You know, you don't just do it in short sound bites. And I feel that we've become sort of this sound bite culture now all around the world. I don't think it's a Western problem. I think it's a worldly problem where we've just become a sound bite culture where, okay, I watched this thing about Unity Church and I know all about it. And it's like, no, you don't. There's a lot more to it than just watching a 10-minute YouTube clip about something. You know, you can't know something deeply like that. And so I think that everything is geared towards speed in the modern world. So people have, since, you know, the last 100 years, since, you know, the airways have opened up and a lot of the long boundaries have begun to dissolve, everyone's contributing to something. You know, we're doing something in the world, but everything is geared towards, you know, progress that's, you know, almost too quick. And, you know, when you take your foot off the accelerator, you realize that, geez, wow, like I was just wound up. I was so tight from all of the speed of society. People feel this, you know, when they go into a monastery or say if they go and do a Vipassana meditation, when they have those first few days that they've just completely stopped everything, they feel different. Because, you know, naturally when you're in a city or if you have a job and you're constantly doing, you're a little bit wound up, tight, and you don't even recognize that. And a lot of us are like this, and we get this from accessing information as well. You know, we're always accessing, we're overloaded with information, we're overloaded with everything these days, and it's all geared towards it's all fast. It's all about speed. It's actually, I wouldn't say that the world is naturally, or there's anyone particularly behind this. It just happened with the advent of modern technology and the way that the world is sort of going at the moment. So, and everybody is engaged in it, and a lot of people don't recognize that they're wound up tight, that their mind is starting to race. You know, we have a lot of problems now with sleep. With mental health issues such as depression and anxiety issues and so forth and so on. And all of these are to do with the speed of the world and how fast your mind is trying to process life itself. And we are not made to process life that fast. We're made to process it in a very natural way, not in a multitasking way, but in a very one-by-one, step-by-step process. And, you know, that's how everything else works in nature. Nothing else multitasks the way we do. So, you know, if someone's, you know, for example, a classic case, Paul, and you know this, we've all experienced it, is when okay, I'm going to write that email and then that you're supposed to do yesterday, and then what you do first is you open up a couple of other tabs, and you have your Facebook on, you have your Instagram, you have your Twitter, you have your YouTube on. And then you start to tackle the email. So you've already distracted yourself before you've even got to the task at hand. And that's an analogy for modern culture, you know. So we're trying to process just way too much. And that's why I believe my book, Fasting the Mind, is, well, for myself personally especially, it was the most important book to write, because I feel that I can feel the tension in the air with people. I can feel it, you know, even within myself. I can sense it, and even in conversations you can sense there's tension in people. It's not that they're naturally uptight. It's just that the world is just, you know, they're just wound up, but, you know, like a yo-yo. So, yeah.
Well, you know, we were, if you've ever been on a meditation retreat, you know, and you come back into the world again, it's like a very difficult sometimes because, you know, everybody's rushing around. When you get in the car, you just want to go about 25, 30 miles an hour because your mind is slowed down during that retreat time. And everybody's rushing, you know, at 60, 70 miles an hour. So it's very disconcerting because you've entered another universe, if you like. You've left the world of distraction and speed. Alan Watts is quoted in your book, isn't he, as saying we are addicted to the dope, and speed can be dope too. You know, even though we seem to be speeding up, we're really avoiding being present. It's another form of distraction. What we need to get to is the antidotes, I guess. So you provide a number of them in the book. So I want to get to some of those, because one thing to talk about the problem, right? But we also want to provide the solution, and this book does provide, like it says, spiritual exercises for psychic detox. I know you provide a lot. One of the things you mentioned earlier was the nervous system, and you talk about hot and cold cognition. As we go to the break, just explain what that is, and then we'll talk more about it in the second segment.
Okay, yeah, well, hot and cold cognition is they're the two main functions of the brain, of the mind, that you could say. So the cold cognition is found in the prefrontal cortex at the front of the brain, and that's the, when we think of as yourself as Paul, or I think of myself as Jason, as the I. That's what you're actually thinking of, because that's the conscious controller. That's the analytical side of our mind. So that's the one that's separating life and, you know, able to intellectualize things. While the hot cognition is the more natural, unconscious part of our mind, and that's found in the more unconscious regions of the brain. And that hot cognition is more to do with naturalness, spontaneity, and you could say even holistic thinking, so thinking about things in a grander sense. So it's much more to do with holism, and these are actually the two, yeah, like I said, the two main functions of the brain, and so I should say the hot cognition is more closely tied to the body. So, you know, I think in the world, Paul, is that when you know, the world's coming to a hell of a lot rational, that rationalism comes a lot from the cold cognition, from the analytical side, and, you know, we develop this kind of this sense of this abstract rationality, which is divorced from the body, from the naturalness, from the spontaneity of the body. And in cognitive science, they're saying that that's actually an incorrect way of seeing the human organism. You know, we are not this mind dragging around this cumbersome body. We're actually embodied cognition. So in saying that, you know, what they say, well, a phrase is that the mind is embodied and the body is mindful. You know, that's kind of a phrase to encapsulate what cognitive science have discovered and are trying to explain. And this is an ancient thing which we can get into as well later on. This is not just a really new information. It's older information that's just been articulated, I would say, a lot better for the modern mind.
Well, and we tend to separate the two, don't we, into distinct parts, you know, the intellectual and the intuitive, or whatever, the analytical and the more creative. But really, yep, they bleed into each other. And the recent Nobel laureate in economics has written a lot about the irrationality of economics, you know, that you can nudge people in certain directions to make decisions, not based on analysis, but on the feeling of it, on what their intuition seems to tell them. And it seems to be irrational sometimes, you know, and they're basing economic models now on this more larger view of how we choose things, rather than just based on reason and logic. And And so, you know, it points to the fact that we are holistic systems. You know, even when we seem to separate ourselves, we can't, because the truth will out. You know, the body mind wants to do its thing, right? It's the natural way, and you talk about this a lot. The way of spirit, the way of the mind, the fasting mind, the way of freedom is the natural way, and I love that idea. It's not like we have to find something that's different from who we are. We just need to uncover who we are, you know, to release the imprisoned splendor, which is that natural, beautiful, perfect being that we are, right? And it's so this isn't sort of forcing ourselves, struggling to do this. It's returning to our natural state.
Exactly, and that was a focus in the East, you know, from a long time ago. We have this idea of this, you know, like I said, this abstract rationality, which it came from philosophers, you know, even from way back as Plato, but more recently from Descartes and Immanuel Kant, who promoted this kind of this disembodied myth where we have, you know, a good analogy is that, you know, I had to drag myself out of bed this morning. It's like, who's doing the dragging here? You know, so we're kind of implying that we're this mind dragging around this cumbersome body, mm-hmm. when that's not really the way things are, you know. And when we realize that we are this embodied cognitive organism, that, you know, we align more with the naturalness of ourselves. And, you know, like what you said, even in economics, that they're appreciating that there's this whole intuitive aspect that's been overlooked. And this is why, especially when people start to criticize things such as religion, you know, it really gets my back up, because when we look at religion as opposed to science, and this goes into Robert McCauley's work, is that religion is much more natural than science, in the sense that religion appeases our intuitions, our natural intuitions. You know, so these are things that cannot be ignored. But in the modern science, and especially with the new atheist movement that's come about, and this super rationalism that's around, these people are starting to ignore this naturalness that is actually, we could say, 95% of actually who we are, as opposed to the cold system, which is an effortful system and not a super efficient system to try and multitask and trying to analyze and speculate about the nature of reality. So when we start to appreciate that, then we can start to appreciate things such as religion, such as other things in the world that appease our natural intuitions and our natural inclinations.
So, folks, I'm with Jason Gregory. We're talking about the fascinating subject of rediscovering your true self through fasting your mind, spiritual exercises for psychic detox. When we come back, we'll look at some more particular ways we can do this work. Join us after these messages from Unity.
Online Radio has helped you grow spiritually through programs like this one, please consider supporting this online radio programming. Visit www.unity.fm and click on Donate Now. Thank you for helping us continue to serve as the voice of an awakening world.
That the Buddha gave us the formula to create a beautiful, abundant life. Did you know that Jesus gave us the formula to create a beautiful, abundant life? Did you know that both these masters taught exactly the same thing? And guess what? They did not teach the law of attraction. They taught the great paradox of prosperity. You can have anything you want. Why, you can have things you don't even know you want, but not by wanting them. Instead, put your attention on the vibrant presence of the divine within. Do that, and your life will change. It has to. That is the natural order. Want to crack the code on the great paradox? Get Janet Connor's The Lotus and the Lily, available everywhere great books are sold.
Where can you hear some of the great spiritual speakers of our day? All in one place. At Unity Village, the evening of October 18th, when the Association of Global New Thought comes to campus. Prepare to be inspired. Hear powerful presentations from Michael Beckwith, Roger Teal, Donna Johnson, Wendy Craig Purcell, Temple Hayes, Ken Gordon, David Goldberg, Kevin Ross, and Unity CEO Jim Blake. If you can't be there, watch on live stream. Visit UnityVillageChapel.org.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Jason Gregory. We're talking about his latest book called Fasting the Mind. And I encourage you to get it if you haven't had a chance to read it yet. Fascinating stuff. He's very grounded in a lot of Eastern philosophies, especially Hindu, Buddhism, Confucianism, things like that. But also with an eye to modern awareness and what's happening in the West, cognition, etc. But in the second part of the show, we wanted to talk about the practical things we can do. And there's a great quote on page 55. Yeah, if you want to go deep, here we go. This is from Shankara, the great Indian philosopher. And he says this conundrum, but it really sums everything up. It says, Brahman, the ultimate, the absolute, is real. The universe is unreal. However, the universe is Brahman, the absolute. So you could say, well, the Brahman is the real, the universe is unreal, but the universe is Brahman. So wait a minute. How do you get your head around that one? So explain it to us, Jason, succinctly in a couple of sentences.
Say, basically, the universe is only real when we perceive it as Brahman, you can say. Yeah. So, it's quite a conundrum. Actually, Ramana Maharishi used to say this to his students, and they used to be so confused because, I mean, it is. It's paradoxical. It makes completely no sense. But the last line does explain sort of the sentiment. It is that the universe is only real when we perceive it as a one system. You could say the one, not being, but just the one energy, the Godhead, you could say. So then the problem in the East, I guess, not the problem, but the focus is to how do we get that perception? How do we begin to see the world that way instead of seeing it in its duality? So we need to see it, in a sense, in a non-dual manner. And so this ties into what we were speaking about before the break, Paul, where we were talking about the cold and the hot cognition. And, so this is not even a new problem, but especially in the modern day where a lot of education and even how we're trained as kids is we focus on the duality of the world. We focus on naming and explaining things. So Paul is Paul, Jason is Jason, black is black, and so forth and so on. So this is really only cold cognition training where we are suppressing our naturalness, our hot cognition. So and our hot cognition, the naturalness of the hot cognition and its perceptions is to actually perceive the world in its holistic way. So, when we see from that place, from that cognitive state, from that more primal state, we actually begin to appreciate that the world is Brahman in its reality, you know. So these are why spiritual practices and especially meditative practices were spawned in the East, was to get back to this state of perception, this naturalness, and trying to develop the ability to see the world in its unity, in its holistic state.
I love the idea in India too of the contrast between Maya and the illusory nature of things, and the Leelas, the playful nature of God in activity. So, in other words, if we buy into the world of illusion as being the reality, then it becomes endlessly confusing, because it is not the reality in that sense. It's just a mirror of the absolute. But once we understand this mirror of the absolute, then it becomes a playful thing, right? Leela meaning playfulness, and we can enjoy the games, if you like, the joyous games of life. How synchronicities seem to show up, how everything seems to be tied together in miraculous ways, etc. It's all part of this play of the universe, and so I think this is a huge part of it. You know, the thing about the cold cognition is it's so heavy and dense and weighs us down, right? And we're rushing around addicted to the dope, as we said earlier. But when we're in the hot cognition of consciousness, if you like, there's a lightness to it, isn't there? There's a joy, you know. We're freed from all the anxieties and fears that we have, and we see that life is a joyous thing. Now, this is difficult to explain to somebody who's going through tragedy or a disease or something, because it sounds a little cold in itself. It sounds like cruel, you know. Oh, it's just a play. It's just it's fun. It could be joyous. But I don't think it's a light kind of joy in that way. It's not sort of spiritual bypass here. We're still dealing with difficulty, but we're saying that there's an inherent buoyancy to everything, right? That we don't have to be weighed down.
You definitely don't have to be weighed down. And like you said, there's... with especially the hot cognition, there's a freeing, a lightness to it, the ability to see things holistically. And this is why, actually, from a cognitive science perspective, this is why people are attracted to spirituality or even religion, because when they read, say, a sacred text, or they read, you know, they could read the Bible or so forth and so on, that promotes, you know, that there's, that everything is God, and you know, we're part of this one thing. This actually frees the, you know, this down regulates the cold cognition, the sense of yourself, and you come back into a more of a holistic state. And it's actually good for you, you know what I mean? It's good to, because it alleviates anxiety, it alleviates stress, and it has this calming effect on your whole system. And you know, this is the promotion, this is what we should be doing. Whereas the cold system is constantly, it's an effortful system. So when we employ it a lot, when we analyze this and that, we actually, it's physiologically expensive. You know, I'm a writer, so I experience this a lot. If I try not to write more than 3 or 4 hours a day, but if I write, like, say, for example, 10 hours a day, and I've been in my cold cognition so long, you know, analyzing and blah, 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 then I'm completely exhausted. You know, I lie on the bed as if I ran a marathon. And this is how we are almost every day when we go to work, when we do all of these things. And you know, to experience the play, the leela, like what you mentioned, Paul, to experience, like in India they say this is like the dance of Shiva, to be fully embraced in the splendor of life, you have to get out of. And you use the other Sanskrit term Maya, and Maya, you know, when we think about it, is related to the cold cognition, because its actual definition comes from matra, which means to measure. So Maya is basically not that the reality itself is an illusion, but it's an illusion only when we start to dissect it in our own mind and we start to separate things from each other instead of seeing it naturally how it is as an integrated system, like what you beautifully said before. And this is the, you know, the nature of the Tao, the nature of Brahman, is that, you know, everything everything is everything. You know, everything is interconnected. It's a web of life. It's not something, we are not isolated beings separated from everything else. And right. So Maya, the idea of Maya, the idea of the analytical cold cognition in us that separates things from this and that is what causes anxiety and causes suffering and causes everything in our life. Now that, like what you beautifully said before, it doesn't mean that you don't grieve if you have personal things in your life. Of course you grieve and this and that. But once you've appreciated the other aspect, you'll deal with these things a lot better. Doesn't mean that you don't, you know, feel grief and this and that. We all do, because, you know, when we lose loved ones, it can be a terrible thing. But you are free of being paralyzed from that. You know, a lot of people are paralyzed when they experience grief, but you're actually free from that. So, you know, the idea in the East is how do we down-regulate this sense of I? You know, how do we down, you basically, what they're asking is how do we down-regulate, which when I say down-regulate, I mean decrease or begin to turn the volume down of the cold cognition, this ability to discern between this and that. And this is why meditative practices and stillness practices especially were born in the East.
Interesting, the Maya and Measure, because Sri Nazagadatta Maharaj talks a lot about, another great Indian teacher, talks a lot about the problem of extension. You know, once we extend things, we see life in a linear term from beginning to end. We extend our understanding of the universe into relationships of up, down, and sideways, space-time. And so we begin to create this false understanding of what the universe really is. You know, it's beyond extension. It doesn't have to extend to anything. It's the whole universe is in a drop of water, if you like. And that's something that, you know, the head that is in linear terms has a hard time getting around. You know, in the world of extension dominates cold cognition. And so to let go of that can be vastly frightening, but also vastly astonishing. You know, can give us a glimpse of the magnificence that we are. A technique you mentioned is nati-nati, right? The idea of not this, not this. You sort of, I have a body, but I'm not the body. I have a mind, I'm not the mind, etc. Sort of tracing it back to, well, what are you? You know, you're not a lot of anything in a sense. You know, you're empty, but that gives you the possibility to be full, right? You want the empty cup so you can fill it with your favorite coffee. If it's already full, you can't use it. So emptiness is a great gift of the universe to entertain all possibility. What else do you talk about? I know you say, you know, try and keep a healthy physical diet, right? Nutritious diet, but also you can do a digital diet. You mentioned deep work. I thought that was an interesting idea. You want to talk about what that means, deep work?
Well, deep work is a practice that's popular with, you know, philosophers and writers and that and poets and that from a long time. The term deep work has been popularized by a computer professor in America, Cal Newport. And deep work is basically the ability to do any creative work distraction-free. You know, so to do whatever it is, your passion, it's distraction-free focus. So, for example, in the book, I explain deep work time blocks. So what that means is, okay, I'm going to write fast in the mind. How am I going to achieve this if I'm constantly distracted by life? Okay, I'm not going to be able to achieve. Oh, I might be able to achieve it, but it might take me a year. All right. So what I'll do is I'll employ deep work time blocks, which means I'm going to take a specific time of the day just to focus on this book and to write it. And you know, you're not always going to get the same results every day. Like so for example, one day I might be able to write two pages, and that might not be enough. But then the following day I might be able to write five. But what's consistent is that I'm going to show up every day for that time block, and I'm going to continue to build momentum. So I explain in the book that I employ this idea for all of my books now that I write. And the irony is that though you think that 3 hours in a morning, 3 to 4 hours might not be enough to write a book, I wrote Fasting the Mind within 5 weeks. So it's and I was having the weekends off, you know, to just spend life with my wife. So, you know, I'd have my deep work session from 8:30 in the morning to 12:30 in the afternoon. So that's what deep work is, and a lot of people a lot of creative people, a lot of people who are successful in the world, they live by this deep work philosophy, and all this ties into fasting the mind in a sense for the creators, because it gives you time to be in distraction free focus. And you know, I tie also deep work into which you were getting into before with the digital detox, Paul, is that, you know, one of the worst things we can do is when we wake up in the morning and the first thing we do is turn on the computer, turn on, you know, check your emails and this and that. That's the worst thing you can do, because this is going to destroy deep work. This is going to develop something called attention residue, which means that when you see something, like, for example, if Paul writes me, I looked at the email first thing in the day, but then I said, okay, I'm going to write now. That residue is still lingering in my mind that I should be tackling that. So the best thing is to avoid all digital devices in the morning, do a deep work session, whatever it is you're passionate about, and then, you know, check your emails and that in the afternoon. But also another key thing in the practice of fasting the mind, especially for people in society who have jobs and so forth and so on, is that when it gets to like 5 or 6 in the afternoon, practice something that is called digital sunset. So what this means is you shut down all digital devices in the afternoon and you just, you know, you live life. You read a book, talk to your significant other or talk to your kids, or just be natural how we are. And what this does is it helps your sleep. It helps your ability to be a better, be more productive and more creative person and more heart-centered person. And even science reveals that a lot of our insomnia and a lot of our bad sleep patterns in the modern world come from being on digital devices at nighttime, because of the blue light in digital devices actually affects the pineal gland. And the pineal gland, naturally secretes melatonin close to bedtime. But what happens when we look at the blue light at night is it begins to suppress the melatonin production because it thinks it's naturally daytime. So, mm-hmm. And so that's when people go to bed and they're clutching at their phone, getting off that last tweet, and then they don't get to sleep for another 3 hours. That's because they've been looking at the blue light all night. And so digital detox impacts your sleeping patterns, which will help you, again, fast the mind and be much more of a present, productive and creative person in the world. And, you know, I've got many other methods in the book for style approaches for just everybody in society to follow, you know. And I talk about that, Paul, which you probably know, the four fundamentals, which is exercise, keeping a healthy diet, prioritizing your sleep, but also meditation, you know, which a lot of people don't consider.
Right. There's a lovely quote too. We're getting close to the end of the show. I wish we could talk for another hour, but you'll have to come back on the show, Jason.
For sure.
But there's a great quote on page 101 from Swami Satchitananda. He was once asked about enlightenment, and he said that enlightenment was not some fantastic event, but rather it's an ease we feel when we have stepped out of the murk of the personality and into the light of God. And really all these techniques are helping us do that, you know, that there is something much more magnificent about us than we take for granted in everyday life. You know, we fill our lives with these distractions, but we are so much more than these things. I was on an island without any digital resources for a week while we were in Scotland, and we were the only people on the island apart from the caretakers, and went through a digital detox, if you like. And it was wonderful. I didn't miss it at all. I got more time to, as you say, go deep with my contemplation and just enjoy the natural world there and realize, you know, what a magnificent place we live in. And even when we're back in, quote, our workplace and doing our everyday thing, it can still be miraculous. You know, I love to watch the birds and the way the play of light in my in my office, in my home. This world is a magnificent place. And thank you, Jason, for bringing your insight. And if people want to get hold of you, do you have a website?
Yep, I do. It's jasongregory.org, so simply my name, .org. And, yeah, you can find me on all through social media. I'm on Twitter at jasongregory33, and I'm on Facebook, on Instagram, all of those things that I talk about
you're in the world, but you're not of the world.
Exactly.
That's the key, yeah. All right, let me tell you about next week, and we'll say goodbye to Jason. Next week, Nikki Scully joins me to talk about her latest book. It's called Sekhmet, Transformation in the Belly of the Goddess. So I don't know how that's going to link in with what we're talking about today, but sounds good. Transformation in the Belly of the Goddess. Getting down and getting into our bodies, isn't it? It's into the visceral, the holistic, the integrating our male and female aspects, and that can only be a good thing. So join us then. But first of all, thank you, Jason, for another great show. I really enjoyed your presence with us today.
Thank you, Paul. I always love speaking to you. You're one of the best hosts out there. And yeah, I look forward to it next time.
All right. Absolutely. All right. Take care. And thanks for listening, folks.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
What if you were intentional about your life, committed to having more energy and being more vibrant? Join Reverend Temple Hayes, spiritual leader of First Unity at Unity Campus in St. Petersburg, Florida, as she guides you on a journey to an intentional and energetic life. Empower your life and fully express the wondrous energy, love, and joy you hold in your wildest imagining. Joyfully and actively know that more important than what happens after you die is the deeper and enriching concern for what happens while you're living. How can you experience an incredible life right now? Learn how each week on The Intentional Spirit, Seeing and Being, Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Central Time, right here on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
You can choose to focus on what you perceive as lacking in your life, or you can change your outlook. You can become wise to wonderful ways of playing the game of life. Count your blessings. Instead of focusing on what you believe is missing, let yourself become aware of how truly blessed you already are. This is the way to build an attitude of gratitude. Give thanks for all of the abundance you're presently enjoying, and for the abundance of every good thing that's on its way to you. Everything you need to be happy is already within you, waiting to be discovered. Unlimited happiness and fulfillment can be yours. Unlock the door to undiscovered treasure by building an attitude of gratitude. This law of life is brought to you by Unity.
To find a Unity Church near you, visit www.unity.org.
Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.